And simply, we thank you, Lord, and thank you for this Shabbat. Ask that you would be with us as we study together this afternoon. Amen. Okay, very good. So we're in the book of Deuteronomy. The portion is Ki Tetzeh, when you go out. And it begins in chapter 21, verse 10. And it gets its name from the first phrase in the first sentence. When you go out to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and you take captives, if you notice among the captives a beautiful woman and are attracted to her, you may take her as your wife. Bring her into your home and have her shave her head, trim her nails, and put aside the clothes she was wearing when she was captured. After she has lived in your house and mourned her father and mother for a full month, then you may go to her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. If you are not pleased with her, let her go wherever she wishes. You must not sell her or treat her as a slave, since you have dishonored her. Now, it would be nice to talk about this one passage for the entire time, but the title for the Captive Woman Seminar is taken from the way that this verse, this passage or paragraph, is often misinterpreted. It's assumed, based upon the rendering of this verse in English, that the woman is mistreated, the captive woman is mistreated and humiliated, but what is done to her is actually done to protect her from someone who cannot control his passions. So the passage should typically, or is understood in a way very different from the way it is typically understood. And there is a whole seminar on the way women are treated today and how they were treated in biblical times. So if you're interested in understanding this, then I would just encourage you to listen to the Captive Woman Seminar. It covers a whole host of issues, including the way many of the passages which relate to women in the apostolic writings have been misapplied and misinterpreted and misunderstood as well. Okay? At any rate, we're going to move on to chapter 22, verse 6. Important passage. If you come across a bed's nest beside the road, either in a tree or on the ground, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs, do not take the mother with the young. You may take the young, but be sure to let the mother go, so that it may go well with you, and you may have a long life. Okay? So there's two issues really related to this particular passage, which we want to look at. The first is addressed in this midrash in the book of Deuteronomy. Rabbi Abba ben Kahana said, "The Holy One, blessed be He, said, do not spend time weighing up the precepts of the Torah, and do not say, seeing that this precept is a great one, I will perform it, because its reward is great, and seeing that the other precept is a minor one, I will not perform it." So what does God do? He did not reveal to His creatures the reward for each separate precept. So when they may perform all the precepts without questioning, right? So the idea here, of course, is that this passage is often treated as a lesser or least one of the precepts, one of the commandments. I mean, certainly, this commandment is nothing like, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, all of your strength, all of your might. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You shall honor your mother and your father, or your father and your mother." I mean, the way you are required to shoo a mother bird away from its nest before you take the eggs or before you take its young, I mean, it's hard to understand how a commandment like this one compares with greater commandments, or commandments that we would consider to be greater. And so, of course, the Midrash says, don't think of the commandments in terms of greater commandments or lesser commandments, because they're all important, right? And in fact, God did not reveal to us the reward for each separate precept, okay? So if you look at the end of this Midrash, so God did not reveal the reward of the precepts except the two, the weightiest and the least weighty. The honoring of parents is the very weightiest. Its reward is long life. As it is said, honor your father and your mother that your days may be long. And the sending away of the mother bird is considered the least weighty. But notice that its reward, which are the only two commandments with a reward, according to the Midrash, the greatest, which is honoring your parents, and the least, which is sending away the mother bird, right? That's considered the least weighty. But the Midrash, the objective of the Midrash, is don't think of them in these terms, because the reward for the greatest commandment and the least of the commandments is the same, length of days, right? So it's a rabbinic way of saying not to think of the commands in terms of the greatest and of the least, but to think of them all in the same way. And we have an obligation to, obviously, the ones that apply to us, all in the same way. Okay? Now, Maimonides states that the mother is chased away to be spared the painful sight of her offspring being taken away. Right? But this assumes that a mother bird experiences pain. Right? So, whether you think that is or isn't true, right, that's not the point. The point is, in Jewish thought, it's true, right? In other words, in Jewish thought, animals, even birds, experience pain, right, can be hurt and damaged, and therefore, we have an obligation to treat them in a certain way. So it goes on to say, it is not likely, however, that chasing the mother away would spare her pain, right? He minimizes this idea, even though it's an idea which is connected to the way Jews think. Because forcible separation from her young and finding them gone later would also be painful, right? So the mother bird is going to experience pain either way, if you send her away or if you take the eggs from her presence, right? The point is that a mother bird does experience some level of pain, whether we really understand it or not. But Maimonides goes on to say, nor do the comparable laws concerning the cattle prevent pain. The mother animal, for example, would not know if her calf or her kid were sacrificed on the same day or boiled in her milk. And the two passages, one from Leviticus 22 and the other from Deuteronomy 14, do not slaughter a cow or a sheep and its young on the same day. How would they know? And the other passage, do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. How would they know? Right? So the point is that they obviously don't know, but there's two considerations. One is to the extent that it's possible to prevent the pain of an animal, we should, right? But the Torah finds that these acts are callous, unfeeling. In other words, according to Maimonides, these are considered callous acts, which are not appropriate for God's people, right? In other words, God's people should be characterized by compassion, by justice, a love for justice, right? A love for nature, a love for the created universe. We should love one another. We should extend care to the creation. We should extend care to animals, right? We shouldn't act callously. We shouldn't treat each other callously, and we shouldn't treat animals callously. So for Maimonides, even though the pain is an issue, it's the acting callously that for him is at the heart of the commandment. Yeshua in Matthew 5 also talks about the least and the greatest of the commandment in a passage we've talked about many times, right? When he talks about that he didn't come to abolish the Torah or the prophet, and anyone who breaks the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom. So we shouldn't think of the commandments in least or greatest terms, right? And of course, this passage in Nedarim, this tractate on vows, talks about this too. Be heedful of a light precept as of a weighty one, for you know not what is given as reward for any precept. Okay, this passage in Matthew 6, I'm sorry I'm going so fast, but I want to get to something here. The passage in Matthew 6 talks about anxiety. Okay? It's a whole statement or story about being anxious, about our inability or unwillingness to trust God, right? In other words, we need to trust God even when we don't understand how or why He is working in our lives. And one of the things that Yeshua mentions is the birds of the air, right? They don't sow or reap or store away in barns, but your Heavenly Father feeds them. So God cares for the creation. He cares for the animals. He feeds them. And yet, we are more valuable to God than they are, which doesn't mean that they are not valuable. In Hebrew is a comparative clause, right? When something is greater than something else, it doesn't make the something else invaluable. Do you understand what I mean? When the author of Hebrews, for example, talks about the way or how the new covenant is superior to the old one, it doesn't make the old one bad. The old one is good, in fact. The new one is gooder, right? That's all he's trying to express. They are both good, but one facilitates our experience in the Olam Haba in a way the other doesn't. So, we are very valuable to God. People are valuable to God. God's children are very precious to Him, right? But the animals are precious to Him too, and God makes a provision for them. So, if God makes a provision for the animals, according to Hebrew thought, how much more will He make a provision for us? That's the idea. Okay, but I want to turn your attention to this passage from the Zohar. If a bird's nest chanced to be before you in the way in any tree or on the ground, young ones or eggs in the dam, the mother bird sitting upon the young, you shall in no wise let the dam go. Right? This passage, he said, we interpret as an esoteric commandment in the Torah. One containing mysteries of doctrines, paths and ways known to the fellowship and belonging to the 32 paths of the Torah. Now, we're obviously not going to talk about any of that, right? Because as interesting as it is, it's not relevant to the point, which we'll get to in a minute. Then turning to Rabbi Eliezer, his son, he said, At the time when the Messiah shall arise, there will be great wonders in the world. See now, in the lower paradise, there is a secret, an unknown spot, broidered with many colors, in which 1,000 palaces of longing are concealed. No one may enter it except the Messiah, whose abode is in paradise. The garden is encompassed with multitudes of saints who look to the Messiah as their leader, along with many hosts and bands of the souls of the righteous there. On new moons, festivals, and Sabbaths, he enters that place in order to find joyous delight in those secret places. Behind those palaces, there is another place, entirely hidden and undisclosed, and it is called Eden, and no one may enter to behold it. Now the Messiah is hidden in its outskirts until a place is revealed to him, which is called the bird's nest. This is the place proclaimed by that bird, the Shekhinah, which is the presence of God, which flies about the Garden of Eden every day. Okay? There's an interesting association between the way the Messiah is revealed and this bird's nest. At any rate, in that place, the effigies are woven of all the nations who band together against Israel. The Messiah enters that abode, lifts up his eyes, and beholds the fathers, the patriarchs, visiting the ruins of God's sanctuary. Notice this section. He perceives Mother Rachel with tears upon her face. The Holy One, blessed be He, tries to comfort her, but she refuses to be comforted. This is a quote from a passage in Jeremiah 31:14. Then the Messiah lifts up his voice and weeps, and the whole Garden of Eden quakes, and all the righteous and saints who are there break out crying. They break out in crying, in lamentation with him. When the crying and the weeping resound for the second time, the whole firmament above the garden begins to shake, and the cry echoes from 500 myriads of spiritual supernal hosts until it reaches the highest throne. Then the Holy One, blessed be He, beckons to that bird, which then enters its nest and comes to the Messiah, and flits about, uttering strange cries, just like a mother bird. Then from the holy throne, the bird's nest and the Messiah are summoned three times. And they both ascend into the holy places, and the Holy One swears to them to destroy the wicked kingdom, Rome, by the hand of the Messiah, to avenge Israel and to give her all the good things which he has promised her. Then the bird returns to her place, the Messiah, however, is hidden again in the same place as before. Right? Now, you are probably wondering why in the world I shared a passage from the Zohar like this. Okay? Look at the note. Whether or not one understands the significance of this mystery, it is interesting the way that the misery of Rachel, the prophecy from Jeremiah 31:14, that Rachel is weeping for her children, are you familiar with it? And she refuses to be comforted? How the prophecy, or the misery of Rachel, is connected to the travail of the Messiah. And of course, in the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew does the exact same thing. So, this statement from the Zohar is one that you might want to, I don't know, reread 15 or 20 times before you begin to get a sense of what it actually says. Right? And frankly, you may never get a sense of what it actually says. But for me, that's not the point. For me, the point is that the author of the Zohar, Yochanan ben Zakkai, connects the travail of the Messiah to the prophecy in Jeremiah 31 about Rachel weeping for her children. The misery of Rachel, because Matthew does the same thing. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and he gave orders to kill all of the boys in Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. Right? Now, this passage from Jeremiah 31 is very important because it clearly expresses the way passages from the Bible are frequently used in apostolic literature. Okay? In other words, Matthew is not saying that the execution of these children in Bethlehem is a fulfillment of the prophecy in Jeremiah 31. He is saying that it is an application of the prophecy. It's a midrash. Matthew is making a midrash on this passage and linking an event in the life of the Messiah to an event in the life of God's people, Israel. And Matthew frequently does this because he wants to communicate the idea that everything that happened in the life of God's people, Israel, is realized in the life of the Messiah. The Messiah is the quintessential expression of Israel. He is everything that Israel was intended by God to be and was not. Okay? It's an important idea. At any rate, let's look at a comment. Jeremiah 31 occurs in a setting of hope. Despite the tears, God says the exiles will return, and now Matthew, referring to Jeremiah 31, likewise says that despite the tears of the Bethlehem mothers, there is hope because Messiah has escaped Herod and will ultimately reign. But there may be a further reason why Matthew quotes this passage from the Tanakh. Here, Yeshua does not, as in verse 15, recapitulate an event from Israel's history, right? It's connected. The exile sent Israel into captivity and thereby brought forth tears. But here the tears are not for him who goes into exile, but because of the children who stay behind and are slaughtered. Why then refer to the exile at all? Jeremiah 31, 9 and 20 refers to Israel. The fact that Israel is Ephraim as God's dear son, and also introduces the new covenant the Lord will make with his people. Therefore, the tears associated with exile will end. Matthew has already made the exile a turning point in his thought. For at that time, the Davidic line was dethroned. The tears of the exile are now being fulfilled. You remember? Well, we've discussed this on Thursday night as we've talked about the genealogy of the Messiah, that the last of Judah's kings was cursed by God. And it is said of him, Jeconiah, write this man childless. Now, he already had children, but God was saying that no descendant of Jeconiah would sit on the throne of his father, right? What's interesting about this is that it seems as if that represented a monumental turning point in history where the promise of God was thwarted. In other words, God promised David that one of his descendants would sit on the throne, but the line of Jeconiah is brought to an end. And God says of Jeconiah, none of your descendants will ever sit on the throne. So, there's only two options here. Either Jeconiah repented the position of the rabbis, of some rabbis, and God restored the Davidic line to Jeconiah, or the solution that Matthew provides in the gospel, that Yeshua, the Messiah, is born of a virgin, but adopted by a man who is in the line of Jeconiah. In other words, because Yeshua is adopted by Joseph, Yeshua is his firstborn son, and therefore can claim to be the fulfillment of the promise that God not only made to David, but to Solomon, that his kingdom and his throne would be established forever. Right? But God made an additional promise to David that he does not make to Solomon, that his house will be established forever. In other words, if Jeconiah does not repent, and there is no evidence in the Bible that he does, then the Messiah must be a descendant of David through another one of David's children. Because he has to be a descendant of David, but somehow also has to be connected to the line of Jeconiah without physically being connected to the line of Jeconiah, right? And so being adopted by Joseph would obviously fulfill that requirement. At any rate, so that's what's being discussed here. The tears of the exile are now being fulfilled. The tears being in the tears begun in Jeremiah's day are climaxed and ended by the tears of the mothers of Bethlehem. The heir to David's throne has come. The exile is over. The true Son of God has arrived, and he will introduce the new covenant promised by Jeremiah. Another observation: the story involving the massacre of the male children in Bethlehem and the surrounding regions echoes faithfully Pharaoh's slaughter of the male infants of the Hebrews. But Matthew works to connect this event in Egypt with another major tragedy in Israelite history, the exile of the tribes to Assyria and to Babylon. In the theology of Israel, the persecution in Egypt and the exile were the two greatest trials to which God's people had been subjected. And the Exodus and the return from exile were the two greatest manifestations of the Lord's protective power. The parallelism is prominent in Isaiah, who described the return as a second Exodus through the desert. If Matthew is interested in the Exodus motif, which imitated the story of Moses, he is no less interested in the exile, which is an event demarcating a major division in the genealogy of Yeshua. Matthew's ingenuity lies not so much in connecting the two events as in relating them to what happened in Bethlehem. The massacre of the male children was a clear reminder of the persecution in Egypt. Bethlehem, where this happened, was also the place on the way to which Rachel was buried. Jeremiah referred to the exile in terms of Rachel weeping over her children. And now her voice is heard from the tomb again, nay, heard as far as Ramah, okay, which is outside of Bethlehem, as the children of Israel suffer persecution once more. But just as God ultimately broke the power of tyrants who persecuted Israel in Egypt and in the exile, so will he frustrate the power of this tyrant, Herod. Thus Yeshua, who is to save God's people, relives both great past moments of divine salvation. A modern interpreter may regard Matthew's exegesis of Jeremiah as fanciful. but it is an exegesis that detects a divine master plan of salvation. And it's only fanciful from a Western perspective, because most Westerners don't think in terms of Midrash when they come across a passage of Scripture from the Tanakh. They think, I have been asked, I wish I had a nickel for every time I've been asked in the last 45 years for a list of prophecies that were fulfilled in the Messiah. Right? And of course, I don't pass out lists like that. You can find many of them. But the lists, frankly, are virtually worthless, because the one who wields the list, who holds the list, assumes that there is a one-to-one correspondence between the prophecy and the way it's fulfilled in the life of the Messiah, when that is rarely the case. I was going to say never, but rarely is probably a better word, like this prophecy here regarding the weeping of Rachel, right? A Christian reading Matthew goes to a Jewish person and says to them that the slaughter of the innocent children in Bethlehem fulfills this prophecy about Rachel weeping for her children. And of course, the Jewish person thinks to themselves, in what way? How is the one event even connected to the other? And of course, the Christian, in most cases, doesn't have any idea, right? Because they don't think these things through. The fact of the matter is that Jeremiah was written 500 years before these events occur. Jeremiah is talking about the fact that the Jewish people are going to be exiled into Babylon, and that many of those exiled Israelites are not going to return to the promised land. Rachel is weeping because of the death of so many innocent children, right, in exile, right? It is as if the back of God's people is broken. The promise that God made to accomplish His purpose in the lives of His people has not been fulfilled. So, of course, it's a source of great weeping by Rachel, who is, you know, one of the matriarchs of God's people. But the whole book of Jeremiah, or at least in this section, is about don't weep, be comforted, because God will accomplish His purpose, and the one God promised would come will come. Right? But that's Matthew's point. Even though these innocent children are murdered in Bethlehem, right, by a king who is convinced he will thwart God's plan to bring a Messiah, that plan is thwarted. Just like the exile was thwarted, after 70 years, the people come back. Just like the plan to destroy the Davidic line was thwarted, because God makes a provision for the coming of the Messiah in spite of the cutting off of Jeconiah's line. Do you understand? I realize this is a little complex. Unfortunately, that is sometimes the way the Midrash works. In other words, as we conclude this, the three, Bethlehem, the city of David, Egypt, the land of the Exodus, and Ramah, the mourning place of the exile, offer a theological history of Israel in geographical miniature. Just as Yeshua sums up the history of the people named in His genealogy, so His early career sums up the history of these prophetic significant places. In other words, as I said earlier, what we see in the life of Yeshua is the history of Israel with all of its triumphs and travails, right? We experience both in the Messiah. We see in the Messiah the history of God's people and their ultimate triumph in the last days when the Messiah comes. Okay, at any rate, let's move on. This next passage, if a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man and the woman are supposed to be brought before the court, and if they are convicted, are to be stoned. So this relates to the passage in John 8, in which case the woman caught in adultery was brought before the Messiah, and he refuses to act against her. Why not? Because the man wasn't brought as well. In other words, had Yeshua allowed this woman to be stoned, he would not be observing the Torah. Right? As it was, he does observe the Torah. Another passage that I wanted to look at just for a minute is this passage in Deuteronomy 23:24, okay, which speaks, when you enter your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat all the grapes you want, but do not put any in your basket. If you enter your neighbor's grain field, you may pick kernels with your hands, but you must not put a sickle to his standing grain. Okay? So, this passage is very straightforward. Picking grapes and putting them into your mouth implies hunger. Right? So if you're hungry, you can go onto someone's property and to take a piece of fruit to satisfy your hunger. But you can't put it in a basket, right? Because putting it in a basket implies theft, right? Because you're gathering fruit. You're not just eating something, you're gathering it. And the same is true of the sickle. You can eat some of the standing grain if you pluck it and put it in your mouth. But if you take a sickle to it, then you're harvesting. Again, you are stealing. So, this is one of the provisions that God makes for the poor in a community, that the poor have the capacity to feed themselves, right? Even though they are feeding themselves on someone else's property. Now, by the way, this obviously does not mean that they can camp outside on the edge of a person's property and just help themselves to anything they want, anytime they want. That's not the point of this. The point of this is that there is a difference between satisfying the hunger of a needy person and stealing someone else's product for yourself. But this relates to a passage in Matthew 12 in which Yeshua went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. Right? So they did exactly what was provided for in the Torah, in our portion. But when the Pharisees saw this, some of the Pharisees, they said, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath day. And Yeshua responds, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? And you remember that story? What David and his companions did when they were hungry? They went to the priest, right, and asked him if he had any food. And the priest said, I don't. He said, but I do happen to have some of the showbread here. And he gave David and his men the showbread that, according to the Torah, could only be eaten by the priests in the holy place, right? So, of course, many people assume, when they read this passage, they assume that the that the Pharisees objected to Yeshua and his disciples plucking grain on Shabbat, when in fact it probably had to do with something entirely different. And if you look in this section, you'll see that what their objection had to do with was the fact that they did not offer a tenth of what they collected to the priest, right? Because that is an instruction in the Torah as well, which is why the reference to what David did, that's what makes it so relevant. The fact that David and his men ate bread that the priests are entitled to by the Torah. And of course, because the Torah, I hate to put this word to it, but because the Torah is a flexible system, it allows, not under normal circumstances, but under extreme circumstances, it allows for the bread, which can only lawfully be eaten by the priest, to be eaten by David and his men, who were from the tribe of Judah, because they were hungry and needed nourishment, right? So their need for food outweighed the requirement that in the Torah that the showbread only be eaten by the priests. Okay? So this next section has to do with that. So I would encourage you to read it because I want to take the rest of the time talking about the final issue. In chapter 24, verse 1. But you can see how an understanding of the Torah and the way the Torah works makes a big difference in terms of the way we understand the apostolic text, right? If a man marries a woman who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her and sends her from his house, and if after she leaves his house she becomes the wife of another man, and her second husband dislikes her and writes her a certificate of divorce, give it to her and sends her from his house, or if he dies, then her first husband who divorced her is not allowed to marry her again after she has been defiled. That would be detestable in the eyes of the Lord. Do not bring sin upon the land the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Okay? So I want to talk about divorce for a minute because there is a great deal of confusion about divorce, about how it works, and what are considered to be legitimate grounds for divorce, obviously based upon what the Torah says. Okay? So the school of Shammai, this comes from the tractate on divorce in the Talmud, the school of Shammai says a man may not divorce his wife unless he has found unchastity in her. For Scripture says, because he has found in her indecency in anything. Deuteronomy 24. So, according to the school of Shammai, sexual impropriety would be a reason, a legitimate reason, for which a divorce may be granted or that action may be taken, if that were to be true of a man's wife, okay? But the school of Hillel says he may divorce her, look at this, even if she has merely spoiled his stew. Okay? So, of course, people read this and they think to themselves, what? Did I just read that properly? A man can divorce his wife even if she merely spoiled his stew. He likes hard-boiled eggs, and she cooked them for 2 minutes, not 6 minutes. So when he cracked them open, they were runny. He can divorce his wife for that? Well, according to the rabbis, that's what it says, right? That's what it says, but of course, that's not what it means, right? Which, as we studied Pirkei Avot, we learned the difference between what things say and what they actually mean, right? For the scripture says, because he has found in her indecency in anything. Notice Shammai puts the emphasis on the indecency, and Hillel puts the emphasis on the word anything. Rabbi Akiva said, even if he finds another more beautiful than she. For scripture also says it comes to pass if she finds no favor in his eyes. Right? So, this is obviously an example in the rabbinic literature of something called hyperbole. Right? Hyperbole is exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. And that's exactly what Hillel and Akiva are doing here. Neither Hillel nor Akiva are suggesting that a man can divorce his wife even if she spoils his stew or undercooks his hard-boiled eggs, right? Neither Hillel nor Akiva is suggesting that. But for the sake of argument, that is the best way to find out what the text actually means. Do you understand? In other words, when it comes to a passage in the scripture that has halachic implications, if you are dealing with a text upon which an instruction or a law is based, and you're trying to discern its significance, how can we apply this principle to our lives? Then it's important, in my opinion, to examine it completely. And part of that examination means looking at it in its strictest application and looking at it in its most liberal application and then finding the middle ground that helps us make sense of what the text actually says. And the previous issue that we discussed is a case in point. The showbread in the temple could only be eaten by the priests in the holy place. Period. No exceptions. But then why does the priest give it to David? Does he violate the Torah in his giving the showbread to David? I mean, obviously he violates the Torah. But it's not considered a violation of the Torah because love is a consideration that transcends that instruction. In other words, in the event, right, and this is what the priest was thinking, David and his men are starving. They have not eaten. And in order for their strength to be sustained, I'm going to give them the showbread. Right? It is scheduled to be replaced anyway, so I'm going to give it to David and his men and let them eat it instead. Why? Because he followed a higher principle. He accomplished a greater good. Do you understand? And so, in the course of rabbinic discussion, that's what happens. Right? Hyperbole is introduced to the equation. Things are exaggerated for the sake of emphasis so that it is possible to come to terms with what is actually intended. And by the way, Yeshua does it too in Matthew 5. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. But I guess none of you have ever sinned with your eyes. It's obvious. You all have both of your eyes intact. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. We all still have our hands, which must mean that we have never allowed our hands to cause us to stumble either. Right? I mean, do you know anybody that follows this instruction of the Messiah? Frankly, if this is a part of the New Covenant instruction as over against the old, I'll take the old. Right? It's more merciful. So this is obviously an example of hyperbole. Yeshua is exaggerating the effect of something to make a point. What's the point? Be careful what you do with your eyes, with your hands, with your feet, right? Be careful what you do. Think through your behavior before you act, right? Which, of course, is a challenge that it will take the rest of our lives to come to terms with, right? But that's what he's instructing us. At any rate, let's look at the notes. When is it time to get a divorce? The Talmud cites three opinions. The school of Shammai rules, a man should not divorce his wife unless he discovers in her an immoral matter. The school of Hillel holds he may divorce her even if she has burnt his meal. Rabbi Akiva says, even if he found another more beautiful than she. All three opinions derive from the same verse in the Torah, Deuteronomy 24:1. In the section dealing with the laws of divorce, depending upon how, a key phrase in that verse is interpreted. The halakha, the final legal ruling, follows the opinion of the sages of Hillel. But pious behavior, midat chasidut, which holds itself to a standard beyond the letter of the law, is to accept the stricter criteria put forth by the disciples of Shammai. In other words, a divorce is justified if there is actual damage to your well-being and the deprivation of your needs. If you find yourself wed to a woman that nightly burns your supper, fouling or depriving you of your material nourishment or spiritual nurture, the Torah understands and condones your decision to sever that relationship and to seek a better marriage. Okay? So in other words, it's not about a woman, or a man for that matter, spoiling a meal or overcooking or undercooking something, right? It involves a habitual practice in which the needs of a spouse are neglected. Do you understand the difference between those two things? It's very important. That is the letter of the law, but a more altruistic approach states that unless your current situation in life spells a violation of your ethical, moral, and religious values, in which case even the sages of Shammai permit, indeed obligate, a dissolution of the marriage, the place to be is the place where you are. Your Creator has placed you there. He has also given you the resources and fortitude to make it work. Sticking it out is not a cop-out. It is to rise to the greater challenge of uncovering those resources. So obviously, divorce in biblical thought is a very serious matter. So I want to move on because this provides the basis for what Yeshua teaches about divorce too. Divorce. From the wording of this verse, it is clear that only the husband can legally initiate divorce proceedings. If the wife, however, feels that there are grounds for divorce and the husband does not agree, she may present her case to the court. And if it is found to be just, they are allowed to force the husband to divorce his wife. And of course, it is a little different today. Grounds for divorce are defined here as an unseemly matter. This somewhat vague term is understood in Jewish law to include a wide range of circumstances, including, but not limited to, incompatibility, physical impediments to marital relations, childlessness, various types of mistreatment, verbal or physical abuse, irreligion, irresponsible, spiteful behavior, and infidelity. Nevertheless, the high value that the Torah places on marital harmony, witnessed by the fact that Aaron is praised as promoting peace between husband and wife, and that God allows his name to be erased in order to rehabilitate a shaky marriage, has always rendered divorce a last resort. In the sage's words, when a man divorces the wife of his youth, the altar itself sheds tears. Thus, despite the broad range of legal grounds for divorce, divorce has historically been relatively rare in Jewish life. If, however, divorce is determined to be justifiable, the Torah attaches no stigma to it. It is considered a perfectly legitimate release from an unenviable relationship. Okay? This next note, the goal of a marriage is twofold, union and children, or companionship and children. Through union with his wife or companionship, a man finds his true companion, his other self, who with her physical and psychological characteristics makes him complete. That is probably the predominant idea, that marriage provides for a completeness that living separately does not. And of course, it assumes that you're connected with the, with your complement. Okay? This union can endure and reach its highest form only when it rises above the immediate and selfish interests of the two parties. This is why the permanence of the union depends on the consecration of the marriage to the service of Hashem. It is this consecration and the united sense of purpose which keeps the marriage from many threats to its stability. It is this consecration which carries the couple through life's crisis. The Talmud teaches that whoever is not married lives without happiness, without help, or joy, or blessing, or redemption. Whoever is not married cannot be considered a complete person. This is a prominent Jewish view. However, in this union, the wisdom of the ages attributes the principal role to the wife. It is on her and her conscience that the performance of perfection of harmony in the home will depend. As the wife, so the husband, teaches an old Jewish saying. Her role, although more reserved and often less acknowledged, is more decisive and more heroic, right? So this obviously includes the idea that a husband and a wife are partners, and they both share responsibility for making the marriage work. And obviously, in traditional Jewish homes, because it is the wife who, for the most part, takes care of the atmosphere in the home, she has a lot to bring to the table regarding how the marriage works. For her role will be to guarantee the smooth running of the family, to guide the first steps of the children in their lives, to surround the husband like a fortress, and to be the spirit that truly creates the home. So that's one of the reasons why the wives are so cherished. Okay? At any rate, it is important to distinguish behavior which is legally acceptable from that which is morally and socially desirable. The fact that a man may divorce his wife if he finds her displeasing does not mean that he is morally right in doing so. To demonstrate the wide boundaries of the legal position, The school of Hillel is recorded in the Talmud as stating that a valid basis for disfavor would be any grievance, such as that she spoils his meals. Okay? In practice, of course, the man's rabbinical counselors would strongly discourage him from placing matters of personal comfort or aesthetics ahead of family stability and his loyalty to his wife. Right? So, we've talked about some of the things for which a divorce is permitted. We've talked about the fact that divorce in Jewish culture was rare. We talked about the fact that even though divorce is permitted, it is not always pursued. So given some of the things that we've just said, I want you to look at Matthew 19 and we'll finish with an explanation of this. Okay? Some of the Pharisees came to test Yeshua or to prove him, to discern his perspective. And so they asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason, like the school of Hillel? And Yeshua responds, haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female. And he said, for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and the two of them will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. Why then, they asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? And Yeshua replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. Right? So in this passage, it looks as if Yeshua sides with the school of Shammai when it comes to the issue of divorce. But what's important has to do with what the word unfaithfulness means. See, it is typically understood to mean illicit sexual intercourse. Right? In other words, for many who read this passage, divorce is only permitted if one of the parties engages in illicit sexual intercourse. That is the only grounds in the thinking of most people for divorce. And of course, it's not required, it's permitted, right? It's something that God allows, but there are other reasons which are connected to this word. If you look in your notes, the word, by the way, in Greek is porneia. It can mean adultery and fornication, homosexuality, lesbianism. It can even be intercourse with animals, right? But it can also be used of a metaphor. It can also be used as a metaphor, used of the worship of idols or the defilement of idolatry. In other words, the word unfaithfulness can apply to the notion of being unfaithful in ways beyond one's sexuality. Do you understand? It's an important distinction, because whereas the word does mean sexual infidelity, it can also mean or refer to other kinds of infidelity, which of course are never mentioned. In another passage in which Yeshua addresses this, the disciples ask Yeshua about divorce, and Yeshua answers, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery against her. Unfortunately, this passage has often been cited as grounds for disfellowshipping someone. But the fact of the matter is that this is not what the text says. What the text says is anyone who divorces his wife in order to marry another woman commits adultery against her. In other words, the fact that a couple is divorced and gets remarried does not make them an adulterer or an adulteress. Okay? What Yeshua is saying in this passage is that if, and of course he's using the man as the illustration, if a man divorces his wife so or for the express purpose of marrying someone else, then it's adultery, right? But if a man divorces his wife and then later remarries, it is not adultery. And in fact, that's what divorce is for. In other words, in the Bible, divorce makes it possible for two people who are in a... I don't want to express this tritely. When a couple are divorced, and I'm going to assume for a moment that the reason is for a legitimate reason. The objective of the divorce is to make it possible for the people to remarry. That's the whole point. Do you understand? And why is that the point of divorce? Why is remarriage the point of divorce? Because as we talked about in the beginning of this section, it is not good for man to be alone. That's why. Because men and women are supposed to be connected together in marriage. That's kind of the way that this works. Something else that's important is expressed in this next paragraph. I've already kind of exceeded what I wanted to talk about, but it's important that you understand Jewish thought regarding marriage and divorce and the way divorce works, because Yeshua's position on divorce is usually defined by this one question that was asked him by the Pharisees. In other words, Yeshua doesn't address any of the other reasons for which divorce was allowed in biblical times. He's not asked about those other instances or those other reasons, and he doesn't address them, right? In other words, Yeshua responds to a specific question about his understanding of the word indecency or anything. In other words, is divorce appropriate based upon how we define indecency or anything? And Yeshua's response is, like the school of Shammai, it's based upon our understanding of the term indecency and not for any reason. Right? So Yeshua does come down on the side of the school of Shammai when it comes to divorce. He comes down on the school of Hillel with a number of other things. But the fact of the matter is that his position regarding divorce was similar to that of the school of Shammai. But even the school of Shammai recognize that the word indecency applies to other things besides sexual impurity. and that in biblical times there were other grounds for divorce that were considered to be legitimate, right? And Yeshua is not asked about those things, and he doesn't respond to questions regarding any of those other grounds that were considered a reason for a divorce, right? So my point, obviously, in talking about this was to address an issue which I consider to be a it's obviously a problem, but it affects the way people are treated, right? Because people are treated in a particular way based, of course, upon one's understanding of the text, right? So one's understanding of the text becomes the litmus test for the way people are treated. And the fact of the matter is that one's understanding of the text shouldn't have anything to do with the way people are treated, right? I mean, obviously I'm not talking about a serial rapist or a serial murderer, right? In my opinion, they should be executed. I'm sorry, but that's what I think. But I'm talking about the way we treat people based upon our sense of whatever sin they've committed, right? And in some cases, we assume that a sin has taken place when in fact it hasn't. But of course, it doesn't change the way we treat them. And in some cases, we treat them in a particular way because of what we've heard about them. Not because of anything that has ever been proven about them. We treat people on the basis of innuendo and rumor and gossip, right? And we treat them that way because they have violated our sense of propriety, what's right and wrong. And in some cases, what we think is right and wrong is based on a misinterpretation or a misapplication or a misunderstanding of the text. Right? So, hopefully some of these things will come up again, and that's the problem. Is because in some cases, some of these things only come up once, and what can you do? So, at any rate, I'm going to stop here and ask if there are any comments or questions.
So it's interesting. I just wanted to share something that I learned today, and I guess I'm a little embarrassed that I wasn't aware of this before. But reading the text of Matthew 12 about when the Pharisees are talking to Yeshua about his disciples plucking the grain, and he makes a remez, right, to David. And he says, David in the temple, I always assumed or understood that David and his men entered into the Holy of Holies or to the holy area and took the bread out of the holy temple. And that's not what happened, because I went back to Samuel and I read, and like you said, he went to the priest and asked the priest for any food. And the priest says, I have nothing other than this bread. But the priest hands it to him, and it was bread that was going to be replaced anyway. But also, it's something that's missed, is the priest asks him if his men are ritually clean.
That's correct.
David responds, yes, they are. So it's not... If you have a mindset that Yeshua came and changed the Torah, this is, and it just had a reading of his brief comment, his remez, Yeshua doesn't go into detail about the ritual purity and all that sort of thing. He just throws it out. And of course, the Pharisees, who are Torah scholars, know the details of the event, but Yeshua doesn't describe them. He doesn't need to describe them.
That's right.
But again, if you read this just for Matthew, you think, here's evidence of Yeshua doing away with the Torah. That's, you can think, if that's your mindset, and your understanding, then this confirms that, what you believe.
Right, but ironically, he actually uses the Torah, Yeshua uses the Torah to justify what he's doing. Right, so he doesn't do away with the Torah, he uses the Torah to say that what he's doing is okay, because here's an example in the Torah where something similar was done, where, you know, in other words, the example he cites had to do with what the priests could expect to receive, and that's probably why he was criticized for gleaning or taking grain on Shabbat. It had nothing to do with Shabbat. It had to do with the fact that that should have been tithed. Whatever was taken should have been given to the priests. And it wasn't. They ate it. You know, because they were hungry, which is what David and his men were hungry. Right? So, there are a lot of other things said about that passage, but the observation is a good one. Yeshua uses the Torah to justify what they're doing. Probably to appreciate the significance of it, or to really get at the information in a way that makes more sense. You're probably going to have to reread the notes. Right? You'll have to reread the notes, but at least you'll have the benefit of some of the comments when you reread them, as opposed to just reading them without the comments, right? Because, like I tell people, it is sometimes possible to read rabbinic material and to think that the rabbis were a bunch of knuckleheads, you know, saying that it's okay to divorce your wife if she undercooks your eggs. You know, they say that, but that isn't what they intended, right? They say it for the purpose of trying to find the middle ground, trying to discern what a text really means and where the emphasis in a passage and on what words, where the emphasis should really fall, right? So sometimes Jewish authors say crazy things, and Yeshua does too, right? Things that seem crazy, you know, like plucking out your eye or cutting off your hand. Not only is it crazy, it's everybody on the planet would be eyeless and handless. Right? So how would we all manage? You get it, right? I mean, it's like, come on. Any other comments or observations? Mary? Yes, there you go.
I just want to thank you because you've given me another way of looking at things. 10 or so years ago, I had a messianic Jewish teacher. And when he found out I'd married someone who was divorced, he totally cut me off and said that I was living in perpetual adultery, and the only good thing was that we didn't have any children because they would have been children of whoredom. And he's a Hebrew and Greek scholar, so it was quite hard. It still is sometimes, well, often. You're coming from a similar background with a similar understanding, and it's good to hear the other side.
My perspective is Jewish. His perspective is Christian. He might be a Hebrew and Greek scholar, but the vast majority of leaders in the Messianic movement are Christian. Their theology is Christian, not Jewish. You are not an adulteress. You have not been living in perpetual sin. And if you would have had children, they would not be bastards. And I appreciate your courage for sharing that. But forgive me, but this is precisely what I'm talking about in terms of the way people are treated. People are disenfranchised. They're disconnected from a community. They're disconnected from the very people that you would think or expect could provide them comfort and support. And they're disconnected from those things because of a doctrinal position. Because doctrine is more important than people. God forbid our doctrine, whether we are right or wrong, should ever be more important than people. It's just, it grieves me to hear you share that. I appreciate the fact that you did, but it... And by the way, can you imagine the countless number of others who are living with that right now? Two. It's just incredibly, incredibly sad. Yeah, go ahead, Roderick. I'm glad. I assumed you would have something to say to this issue.
I want to join you in saying to Mary how much I am grateful for her courage to speak up and the trust that she has placed in all of us in sharing something so intimate and close to her. And I echo your heart, Bob, in this lesson today and your comments now to Mary. I am deeply disturbed, but not just in this moment, but for the last most of all of my life, I have known men and women who have had divorce, and I have known men and women who did not choose divorce, but remained in an unfruitful, unproductive, unsupported marriage that was not only destructive to them, but to the other and to children and to others around. You're right, Bob. The truth of the Torah is so liberating that divorce is so that the others can marry again. It's like the Lord has provided for those who need it a do-over button. We can hit the do-over button and we can try again. Not everybody has to do that, but sometimes people need to. And when they do, it is so liberating, it is so fruitful, and the purpose of God is no longer thwarted. It can be realized for all the parties. Because it's about accomplishing God's purposes on the earth. It's about the Tikkun Olam. It's about the repair. And sometimes relationships need repair. And sometimes relationships are repaired because we choose to go in different directions. And there's a pathway for doing that. I am so grateful to this lesson today. I am so grateful for the explanations and the direction and the insight. This is equipping us and tooling us that we can encourage one another, elevate one another. Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Roderick. I appreciate you sharing. Sunflower asked a question about being incomplete. The fact of the matter is that the Bible describes the creation of Adam and Eve as complements. In other words, it's like, I don't know if you remember in the temple, there was a portico over the main gate into the temple courtyard. It was held up by two pillars, right? Those pillars in the Torah are referred to as complements. The two of them are required to hold up the portico, this roofed structure over the gate that leads into the temple area. And if one of those pillars would have failed, the roof would have come down, right? So that's the language that's used of Adam and Eve, that they complement each other, that both are necessary for what Roderick mentioned, tikkun olam, right? In other words, men and women are to be partners in this world in a variety of ways. Marriage is just one of the partnerships, right? But women and men have the same intrinsic value to God, are equally capable of scholarship, of being anointed with the gifts of the Spirit, being used of God. I mean, fulfilling whatever God has called them to, right? I mean, so that's the sense in which, in Jewish thought, an individual is considered incomplete without their complement. It is not to say that there is something wrong with them, right? But frankly, this idea, I used to think years and years ago that I was an island, right? I was an island. And some of you may have felt that way too. But I learned that I wasn't. And the fact of the matter is that people, we need others to interact with, to be connected to be supported by, to support, right? In other words, it is politically incorrect to say these days that an individual is incomplete without others. But the fact of the matter is that is the way life works. Right? It's nice to imagine that you're capable of anything, you know, that all you have to do is, you know, rip open your shirt and to reveal the big S on the costume on the inside. But, of course, none of us has superpowers, and none of us are really complete on our own, right? We may imagine we are. But the fact of the matter is we're not. We need each other, right? We need each other for all of the reasons I just mentioned. And that's why the Bible is so full of passages that speak of the importance and the value of the connections that we have with each other and the way a community is intended to function. And even passages like, you know, like two is better than one. Right? Why? Because sometimes one gets in trouble and needs the support of another to help them out. Right? I mean, it's just not possible to go through life without, in my opinion, without realizing that life ultimately comes down to that. That we need each other. And it's important that we learn the way that works, right? And there was another comment. Charlene made an interesting observation with which I wholeheartedly agree and have felt for a long time. Understanding the Bible, understanding the Bible from the perspective from which it was written, and especially understanding the real meaning of the Torah, is freeing, something Roderick mentioned as well. It takes burdens off us and frees us from bondages that have been placed upon us by those who we one time looked to for help or guidance. Right? So, Others responded to that statement with a hearty amen, which I do as well. And Ed, I appreciate your comment too. Very good. And Wanda. The lesson has given several people a lighter heart. I'm thrilled that has happened. I'm thrilled when the Lord, when a person is relieved of some of the unwarranted baggage that they carry. You know, we all have baggage to carry, right? But frankly, none of us need to carry any extra. You know, the load is heavy enough the way it is without any additional weight being added to our burden by others whose doctrinal purity is more important to them than how well we bear under whatever burden we must travel with, right? I mean, the fact is we all travel with something, right? None of us are sprinting to the finish line. We are all taking one step at a time, right? Very good. Any other comments, observations? I appreciate your comments. And please reread the notes, and hopefully it'll make even more sense. I covered it as best I could. Okay. So, God bless you guys. I pray that the Lord would bless you with a wonderful Shabbat, or with what's left of it, wherever you live. And it'll be easier to say as our days get shorter and shorter. It'll just be easier to say Shavuot Tov, to bless you with a wonderful week, instead of what's left of your Shabbat, because pretty soon there won't be much left of our Shabbats when we're finished. So this is my favorite time of year, coming into the fall festivals, the fall holidays, the fall weather. I love everything about the fall, the rain. So anyway, this is a good time of year. I enjoy when the temperature changes. So God bless you guys. May the Lord be with you. And Lord willing, I will see you on Thursday night. Otherwise, next Shabbat. Okay, so God bless you guys.